tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. You're hanged if you do and hanged if you don't, is the way the United States begins to feel because of our deep involvement in weapons sales to intractable enemies in the Middle East. It's been revealed by the very powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the purchaser of those arms becomes dependent on the United States in much the same manner as a local automobile dealer becomes dependent on Detroit, which means that the continuing sale of super sophisticated weapons to non-industrial states in the Middle East involves a military commitment on the part of the United States, which, if you could imagine the consequences into the next round of Middle Eastern war, might go something like this. Do you remember that in 1973 the United States had to airlift massive shipments of arms and ammunition to the Israelis in a commitment which apparently had the undertones of knowledge in Washington that had they been dragged to the point of near extermination, of their cities being bombed, of the nation going under, of an absence of replacement for their military supplies, the Israelis just might have used an atomic bomb. Well, nevertheless, those conventional weapons were resupplied. So was the ammunition to feed them. But what if the new scenario goes something similarly, except this time the participants on both sides of the Middle East entanglement are losing weapons at a tremendous pace, expending ammunition, bombs, rockets, mortars, and bullets at a tremendous pace? The United States is the chief arms supplier for, in many cases, both sides. For example, those six C-130 Hercules were the beginning of what is viewed by most people as a continuing number of sales of arms to Egypt. Many people saw that as just one more barrier being broken down in the Middle East, with the Russians being basically replaced by the United States in some of those very volatile countries over there as the chief arms supplier, that American was winning leverage, winning influence, because now we were beginning to supply some of the Arab states with arms instead of the Soviet Union. Well, I suppose people could argue that that's well and good. It helps our economy. It gets a little more balance in our balance of payments deficits. It puts us in the black with overseas shipments and all of that. But on the other hand, what about some new round of war in the Middle East where the United States finds itself committed now not only to resupplying the Israelis, but to resupplying maybe Iran or Jordan or Saudi Arabia or Egypt too? What do we do then? We can't resupply them with manpower. Let's assume that the war goes on, this time to the point the United States is making massive shipments of replacements, spare parts, new weapons, and ammunition to Egypt, Jordan, Iran, to Israel, to Saudi Arabia, and I guess the list is endless. What it means is that we are involved into a hanged-if-you-do and hanged-if-you-don't, caught-in-the-middle, dangerous dilemma in the Middle East, which increasingly is becoming the most militarized part of the face of this earth. And it also means that the United States is involved in a lot more than just the exporting of some expensive toys for a lot of military types to parade around the desert with. That when that powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee revealed that the purchaser becomes dependent in the same manner as a local automobile dealer becomes dependent on Detroit, that means the following. It means that from 50 to 60,000 American military technicians and their dependents, with all that that means, have you been reading recently or seeing in television what has been happening in Iran? With the murder of a couple of Americans recently, with guerrilla overtones, American presence there becoming increasingly a volatile domestic political issue, trying to bridge the gap between the village life and the taboos in public of the dress of women and the mannerisms and habits of the average person, with American communities revolving around military technicians, is going to be very difficult, to say the very least. And yet it's been revealed now that between 50 to 60,000 military technicians, and maybe even more, would be needed by 1980 to help maintain and operate that $10.5 billion worth of arms that Iran has purchased from this country since 1972. You see, it's already been revealed that With all of those hovercraft, forestall destroyers, zero-zero capability helicopters, the troop-carried anti-tank rockets, all of the supersonic, unbelievably powerful F-14s that we have delivered, that the United States could not see Iran go to war without U.S. support on a day-to-day basis. And isn't that whole thing crazy when you stop to think about it? You know, potential or real enemy states used to understand that the United States of America had developed a new weapon when it appeared in the skies over their country, such as the Germans, who looked up in amazement to find American fighter aircraft accompanying those bombers all the way to Berlin. And the Soviets, of course, still do that. By now you've read about the Soviet pilot who they think screamed defection only after he got caught because of a blurb on his fuel and landed at a North Japan air base with a MiG-25, no less. Now that's 3.2 at least times the speed of sound. Isn't it amazing that the Soviet Union, for all of our American intelligence organizations, the British intelligence, the French intelligence, the West German intelligence, and all the Western powers, including Japan, vying, no doubt, and sometimes sharing with each other, trying to obtain Russian secrets, the Russians managed to produce aircraft far superior to our own. Excuse me, I'm sorry, did that hurt? Pardon me, but it's true. Just like the West Germans are still building tanks superior to ours right now today. I don't know what there is about our own system which doesn't allow us to copy other people if they got a product that's better. Maybe it's pride. Maybe we just would decide, well, let's go ahead with slower, less maneuverable, inferior products that are not quite up to snuff compared to some of the enemy materiel because it says made in America. But the point is, here was a secret triple sonic and then some aircraft that the West had never even seen before. And because apparently of a fuel mismanagement problem, the pilot lands at a North Japan air base, begs them to cover it up, fires a couple of pistol shots in the air, acts like anything else except a defecting Russian pilot, which he later decides that's what he is, and claims that he brought his aircraft now because he wanted to escape the Soviet Union. Well, that'll be a political furor between the Japanese and the Russians. And, of course, the United States is reduced to a spectator in the wings because we have no sovereignty, no claim, no control. But can't you imagine how the people in our military would sure love to be able to pour all over that airplane and crawl up in it and look in it and inspect it and fly it and find out about it and get all the specifications on it? Not that we would just go back and tool up and copy it and do it even better. That would be obscene. We can't admit that the MiG is better than something we manufacture at Grumman Ironworks. But nevertheless, and Grumman Ironworks, by the way, is an affectionate term that all pilots who fly Grumman equipment, including World War II veterans who flew those old Wildcats, Hellcats, and Bearcats, that had nothing but tremendous respect for the powerful gear, the powerful airframe, the tremendous armament, and, of course, the protective armor plate that they put in there to preserve pilots' lives. But nevertheless, I could imagine that some of the people at McDonnell and Douglas and Grumman would like to get their hands on that MiG. What? I don't know what we'd do with it, come to think it, if we did get our hands on that MiG. What would we do then? Well, we'd probably manufacture a few hundred of them and sell them to the Shah of Iran, and leave our own Marine Air Corps and Naval Air Corps and Air Force with their tongues hanging out, hoping they could get their hands on a few of them in a few more years. But it's been revealed that when we start those arms sales into foreign countries, we don't let them off the hook or vice versa for who knows how many years. So it could conceivably drag this country, albeit unwillingly, into the next round of a Middle Eastern war. Now, in Saudi Arabia, the Washington government has agreed to sell thousands of laser-guided smart bombs. Those are Maverick air-to-surface missiles and TOW anti-tank missiles to Saudi Arabia. And these sales come on top of $6 billion in American arms contracts already signed with Saudi Arabia over the past couple or 3 years. Now, those air-to-surface missiles, that's a laser-guided bomb released from a fighter bomber such as a Phantom and the aircraft with which we are also providing the Saudi Arabians, of course, must be unbelievably effective and accurate. And, of course, those anti-tank missiles are the types that can be carried by troops and are tremendously effective. It's really a very sophisticated late-generation bazooka type with a far more powerful armor-piercing explosive than ever before, which is far more accurate. And it can blow up, I guess, the biggest tank or any two of them that have ever been made. When you take a look at what we're doing in Jordan, the neighbor right there across the other side of the bank to Israel, one of the nations surrounding Israel, along with Lebanon, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, well, Jordan decided to buy a $540 million American air defense system after threatening to turn to Moscow for weapons over a financial squabble. You might remember reading about that in the news. Saudi Arabia agreed to foot the bill, so the result was the United States is going to remain Jordan's prime supplier of military equipment. Now, we're the prime supplier for Israel and for Jordan. Even though Jordanian troops might have been fighting on the Syrian side, there was no actual combat going on between the borders of Israel and Jordan last time. But it's not inconceivable that that could happen at some time in the future. To me, it's somehow obscene that the United States, which morally, spiritually, and emotionally is committed to the preservation of the State of Israel, at least so you would think, and at the same time is busily involved in sales, if not loans and outright gifts, of some of the most fantastic arms we are capable of producing to many of the nations surrounding Israel. Now, besides those other countries, we're also, of course, deeply involved in providing Israel with advanced weapons. Arms deliveries to that state in the fiscal year now current would total about $1.5 billion, with at least another billion set for the 77 fiscal year. And I already mentioned that we started now by knocking down one of the barriers to beginning arms supplies to Egypt. So, of course, some of the confusion you begin to wonder about, which must really boggle the minds of some of those in the Senate committees in the United States and some of those all the way up to the White House, would simply be, should we let our technicians remain there and participate in the hostilities the way the Russians had, so that eventually, I suppose, it is not inconceivable that American observers, if not radar operators or maybe pilots, would be flying in the back seat of some of those supersonic aircraft over the skies of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, maybe Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And Americans, conceivably, I suppose, could end up fighting Americans in aircraft with different insignia painted on them when the other folks run out of young pilots. Now, that, of course, is ridiculous to speculate about, but you begin to wonder. Because in another Arab-Israeli war, should the United States then mount a large-scale resupply operation for our clients on either side, or both sides, or all sides, or just one side? I mean, how are we going to decide who to resupply? Now, right now, the United States, according to the Shah over there, doesn't have any choice. He claims we don't have a choice about supplying him with weapons. We have no choice, he said, but to supply large amounts of arms to his country. He claims that his country needs three times as many weapons as it has to catch up with its neighbors, who he claims have only a third of Iran's population. And the Shah claims that in 10 years he wants to be as strong as West Germany and France and Britain are right now. And he keeps telling the United States, now look, you know, there are lots of places for me to go shopping if you don't like my buying stuff where you guys are making it there in the States. Well, of course, I could go over and buy it of those people in France. They're pretty hospitable. They sell a lot of wonderful aircraft to people in Africa and Central and South America and all around the world. I'd be glad to buy from Britain or West Germany. They make pretty good arms over there. So the Shah said, the question is, can you, the United States, afford to lose Iran either as a friend or a customer? Of course, the United States is scared half to death with the idea of a nation right there on the border with the Soviet Union and overlooking Israel and in such a strategic location with regard to the raw materials and supplies, especially oil, because Iran was one nation that didn't join the OPEC countries in the embargo, and the Iranians, of course, kept the oil coming. The United States would do practically anything, I suppose, to even shipping a White House, Statue of Liberty, and maybe, as long as they're going to do that, they might as well throw in the UN building as the most worthless of any building we could imagine in United States territory and ship it along to the Shah with all these arms we're sending. So the Shah asked rhetorically, so do you have any choice, he saying this to Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. What other alternatives do you have, he says? Nuclear holocaust or more Vietnams if the U.S. does not help its friends. The Shah denied all charges that his big arms program he's been top of over there has been badly handled or mismanaged. He just climbed in that if any more technical problems arise, well, he'll just hire American civilians rather than more U.S. military personnel to help out. He is saying that he won't accept any restraints on a sale of American products, including a little bit of irritation voice in Washington recently and widely scattered around in press reports of a very deep and growing reluctance to see the United States involved in the sale of nuclear reactors to Iran. But I think the Shah's handled that problem very nicely with his straight-from-the-shoulder statements to Henry Kissinger. He said, really, you can't afford not to send me all the arms I want because you don't want to lose Iran either as a customer or a friend. And I don't know what Dr. Kissinger's reply was to that, but I could imagine that you will see continuing shipments, including the reactors, 8 to 10 of them worth about $1 billion apiece. Even though the Shah and Henry Kissinger agreed that more negotiations are necessary before they really firm up the deal, you can bet that we will sell anything and everything the man wants. And of course, Iran is slated for the biggest arms package in memory, as far as anybody can recall. The Pentagon has notified Congress that it plans to sell nearly $6 billion in arms to 10 countries, including, listen to this, 2,500 missiles to Saudi Arabia and 160 of those F-16 jet fighters to Iran, the one that I reported on from the Paris Air Show where we saw the thing perform spectacularly and which, of course, beat out the Saab Vigen along with other entries from other countries, including some in combination with France and West Germany in competition for the new NATO lightweight interceptor. The administration sources quoted indicated the totals of Sidewinder missiles and Maverick television-guided air-to-ground missiles for Saudi Arabia might have been trimmed in the last few moments, but nevertheless, it's still the biggest arms package in all of history. Now, about 5/6 of that would go to Saudi Arabia and Iran. They would account for about $5.1 billion of the deal out of $5.9. Other equipment would have been earmarked for Singapore, Norway, Morocco, Pakistan, Australia, West Germany, and other places. Maybe a million or two or three or ten here and there, dribbles and bits. But the largest chunk was going to those two countries in the Middle East. Sharply rising arms sales in recent years to Iran and Saudi Arabia have been causing a good deal of perplexity and criticism from the folks back home. So some of the congressmen, in voicing some of the alarm from the grassroots, have been trying to tell these people that we're feeding an arms race in the Persian Gulf and providing modern arms for countries that might just turn around to use them on Israel in the event of a future Middle Eastern war. But if it comes down to the morals of the dilemma as opposed to the dollars in the deal, you can always just about bet what will be the final deciding factor. The arms makers, the arms industry, and of course the balance of payments problems of the United States needing to have a tremendous avalanche of exports no matter what they are and how many people they might kill when the dumb things explode, that has to do with keeping jobs back home. And any government, I say any government, any pretending or any hopeful administration or new administration which is going to go about the business of creating jobs and trying to keep men off the street and in the factories are going to have to make sure those factories are busy. And one sure way to do it is making sure that the United States remains one of the largest traffickers in arms, all the while screaming for world peace. I guess we make statements about wanting world peace and dreaming about world peace and hoping for world peace almost as often as Big Dada Idi Amin does. Have you heard some of the latest statements? I better not get off on that. I just get almost, you might say, mildly irritated. But we make plenty of statements about world peace at the same time. We are delivering arms almost by unprecedented amounts to countries all around the world. It just doesn't seem to be right somehow, but that's exactly what we are doing. Now, in the meantime, the Soviet Union has apparently achieved strategic superiority, not just parity or equality, over the United States in some of the most important areas of strategic missile superiority. The Soviet Union in the last 10 years has forged ahead of the United States in most of the five major categories that are used to measure that balance between the two countries. Russia apparently has 2,507 long-range missiles and bombers to our 2,097, and that was compared to a 4-to-1 advantage that the United States had about 10 years ago. So they've caught up remarkably to overcome our 4-to-1 superiority by a slight superiority of their own. In megatonnage, it's now told that the Soviet Union, in terms of the destructive power of their missile warheads, would lead the United States by a 2-to-1 edge. Or in terms of tons of explosive equivalent, 3,735 to 1,930 megatons. That's a million tons. That's 3,000 million tons. In throw weight, and that's the way they assess the ability of those big booster rockets the Soviets had that we haven't quite yet achieved, the ability to launch in terms of millions of pounds of deadweight, the Soviet Union is ahead 8.2 million pounds to America's 3.3 million. In bomber payload, the United States apparently maintains quite a large edge, 22.8 to 4.7 million pounds. And in MIRVs, we're apparently still ahead by 8,500 and some to 3,250. But they claim that the Soviet Union is certainly going to narrow that gap, and as I've reported time and again in the SALT talks, where we, in one sense of the word, halted production or expansion and deployment of our own MIRV systems to allow us to catch up in the throw weight area and to allow the Soviet Union to catch up in the MIRVs area. And there's a great deal more involved because we've seen recently that most authoritative book, which is very much viewed by governments as authoritative, James' book of Fighting Ships, indicates that the Soviet Union has been moving ahead very rapidly in terms of submarine strength, that they're way ahead of the United States in that. We've seen their naval units appearing in oceans around the world increasingly. The United States is ringed by Soviet nuclear submarines, and of course the presence of the Soviet Navy in the Mediterranean and now in the Indian Ocean and other oceans around the world is quite well known. The editor of that book, once high in British naval intelligence, warned when in the past a country with few overseas financial or colonial interests has embarked on the building of a considerable fleet, the true aims of the ships concerned have proved to be not only for the protection of the homeland, but also aggressive activities designed to support national policy. And remember that new book that was so sensational when that Soviet admiral for the past 25 years, called the father of the modern Soviet Navy, revealed precisely that. Identified that the United States was that unnamed enemy of previous statements in the Soviet press, and identified that the growing might of the conventional as well as nuclear-armed Soviet Navy was definitely an extension of Soviet foreign policy. So military adventurism and the interception of the flow of vital supplies, the unbelievable statement that man made in that book, which you just can't believe, because, you know, in years and years gone by, in two world wars, the United States of America has looked upon that vast Pacific and Atlantic as some of the most vital protection we could have. Our very isolation from the wars in Europe and Asia have meant the ability of the United States for 200 years to continue to grow and to thrive in prosperity and basically, at least the bulk of the time, in peace. But now that father of the Soviet Navy claims that the Soviet Union is fully capable of completely blockading all U.S. ports. Can you imagine the time that has come that the United States of America is facing a growing threat from the Soviet Union of an expanding colonial empire, of the Soviet Union achieving nuclear superiority in strategic, that's intercontinental ballistic missile systems, superiority in their civil defense mechanisms of radar able to jam our Minutemen installations and missiles, therefore apparently rendering them virtually ineffective and protecting up to 90% of the population of the Soviet Union, which makes it a whole new ballgame, which means Washington thinkers are going to have to face the future years with the sure knowledge that our decades-long policy of being able to present the Soviet Union with such a threat of instant, unacceptable retaliation that they would simply look upon a nuclear war as unthinkable. Now we see the Soviet Union has not been following that policy of merely achieving parity or a balance, a nuclear stalemate, a standoff. Instead, the Soviet Union has been following the policy of how to wage and how to win a nuclear war. Their leaders apparently do not look upon nuclear war as unthinkable. Instead, they look upon it as highly probable, and probably some of them look upon it as necessary. Senator Ribicoff recently gave a dire warning, reflecting the fear in Congress that the long-standing United States effort to promote nuclear energy for peaceful purposes is having quite the opposite effect around the world. He claims that the export of atomic reactors is accelerating the spread of nuclear weapons because many nations refuse to limit the use solely just to the peaceful purpose of generating electricity. Instead, they want that plutonium because, of course, the unbelievable political power it would give some struggling third world undeveloped nation to have a gleaming new nuclear reactor sitting out there with the ominous whirring away of the production of plutonium, the knowledge of any neighboring countries, any potential nearby enemy states where they might want the raw materials, the labor force, where they might want access to the sea, they might want whatever it is the enemy country has. Well, the presence of a nuclear reactor and generating plutonium from it is not lost on anyone. More than 290,000 additional megawatts of capacity are operating or are planned outside the borders of the two superpowers, and by 1990, reactors in those third world underdeveloped countries would be able to account for an estimated 3,000 atomic bombs per year. Now, of course, those reactors aren't produced by the American Army. They're produced by Westinghouse Electric. You know, I mean, we're in the business of a free enterprise competitive system of providing jobs for these people in these big factories. And if we don't ship all those arms to Iran and all those anti-tank weapons to Saudi Arabia and all those nuclear reactors to little countries around the world, then we're going to have a terrible problem with a lot of joblessness in this country. And of course, we couldn't contemplate that, because if people lose their jobs, well, they're likely not to be able to buy that new boat or the new home or take that vacation. And in order to be able to have those things, why, we need those jobs, and we've got to have those jobs producing those weapons to make the world safe for Mali and safe for Tanzania and safe for Guinea and the Congo, and safe for Angola and Cuba and all those other countries where we're going to send arms and nuclear reactors. It's an unbelievable world in which you live. You know, there's only one magazine I know that dares to take Bible prophecy and to show you whether or not we're looking toward a new dark age in which plutonium replaces gunpowder as the explosive of choice. And that's the Plain Truth magazine that dares to take Bible prophecy, tells you that the big nations of this earth are identified in the pages of the Bible, and tells you exactly what is the program being worked out here below. You ought to write, too, for that booklet, How to Understand Prophecy. How to understand some of the very difficult passages of those books of Revelation and the book of Daniel and Matthew 24 in the Bible. Write for that free magazine, The Plain Truth, a magazine of understanding, showing you what's happening in West Africa right now and about the British sterling taking a pounding, prediction earthquake, and education. Who needs it? And also that booklet, How to Understand Prophecy. You can dial the toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444 for your free copy, or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.